Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes. It's the 11th of January, 2026. It's probably 7:30 in the morning. I've been up since about 6 o'clock, lit the fire, and managed to get that going. It's been a stiff morning. One of the things I have to do when I get up is exercise the old body, loosen it up, get the muscles all working, and slowly but surely I can function to some degree. Not 100%, but perhaps 80%, which is better than nothing. I've just been smoking my pipe, which actually I shall pause, because smoking and talking obviously are not too conducive. I have a glass of water here, which I have energised with this special app that I have, that actually produces a vibration in the water to give it additional life, so that it helps hydrate the body in a way that just plain water doesn't. So it kind of structures the water in a different way to perhaps some of these vortex machines that people have. This was given to me by the very lovely Phil, who came on the channel a year or so ago and demonstrated how powerful water is. And of course, because we are pretty much water ourselves, 75% I think physically and 99% and some other thing, can't remember now, it is important obviously to be hydrated and to have the correct type of water. Anyway, so that's what I'm having as much as I can. And shortly, I will start the regime of the various supplements, vitamins and things that have been helping me with this strange muscle condition. And tomorrow, I am seeing the osteopath to see what they make of it. I've had so much help, as you can imagine. But I can't say it's all working, or it's all working. If it is, it's working very slowly. There's no sort of miracle cure as yet, although I'm expecting one day just to wake up and find it's all gone in the way that I woke up and found it was all here. It wasn't it wasn't a gradual process. It just suddenly started. Anyway, I've been briefly sitting down reading a bit of R.F. Delderfield, who is an author that I really enjoy for fiction. I'm reading The Dreaming Suburb, which is a book about an avenue of houses in the just before the 1940s and before the outbreak of war, between 1919 and 1940. So at the moment, I think it's 1926. The Great Depression is on. And it, you know, it takes these historical events and how ordinary people, and many of them in this different avenue south of London, I think it is, manage and cope. And it's very, what I like about it is just sort of little stories, really, of the people's lives. And you follow one character and their life, and then you follow another character, and you come back, and they intermingle occasionally. And it's a saga, you know, and R.F. Delderfield is very good at sagas. He's got a brilliant way with him and an amazing imagination. Sad that he died, I believe, at 60, and he probably had a hell of a lot more to give. And isn't that a shame that various people seem to die? They do amazing work and then they die young. And others sort of get going really in latter life. I think of people like Margaret Rutherford, who was an actress, of course, and famed for her Miss Marple appearances in the films in the 50s. But she'd been acting all her life and had managed some form of success. But, you know, bigger recognition came and in her latter life. And this is, of course, the case in many people. People, if... just have to keep going, really. It depends what your what you're looking for. Some people are not looking for that sort of recognition or success. They just do what they do, and if luck is on their side, they're recognised, and perhaps that helps them financially. I think those people who seek to be famous for the sake of being famous, of course, are incredibly shallow. People sometimes say to me when I meet them, oh, it's the famous Richard Vobes. And I think to myself, well, I'm not famous. Excuse me, blowing my hooter. And I don't want to be famous. I don't want to be able to not walk down the street, for example, and have everyone poking their noses at me. It's nice occasionally when somebody comes up and says, oh, I've been watching your videos and thank you very much. They've really helped. You know, and that's why one does it. Oh, I seem to have got a nosebleed now. Just blew my hooter. And suddenly the nose is bleeding. Oh, that's rather convenient, isn't it? I might just have to stuff this up the old nostril to sort of stop the bleeding. Bear with me whilst I sort out the pug. Oh yeah, there's a lot of blood there. Well, I didn't intend that this morning, I can tell you. I was perfectly fine until I blew my hooter. Yeah, I can feel it dripping now. Bear with me. Right, let's just get this plug organised. There we go. I've got something stuffed up there. I know you're supposed to pinch your nose and put your head back and things. But I just hope that this will staunch the flow for a moment whilst I continue to chat to you. The blood dripping out of my head. So yes, I'm enjoying that, and I have over the last period not been very productive, as you will imagine, with this strange condition. But I have been trying to get to my second book and get that written. It's a book that I worked on some years ago as a children's story. And it concerns a farm in Sussex. And really, the central character is this young girl called Molly, who's about 12 years old. And I wrote the basic story as a first draft. But I realised as I wrote it, I'm not really writing children's stories because my turn of phrase is a bit too grown up. And children, it seems to me, do not read A, sufficiently, and B, books of not enough children. I mean, I'm sure there are children, but they're not reading in significant numbers the sort of books that will pull them up. And publishers are not interested in, I suppose, my kind of writing. But having written Biggleswick, it struck me that this basic little story that I've got set in 1940 at the beginning of the Battle of Britain, in which the civilians were at the mercy of the enemy flying in and dropping their bombs and became part of the front line without, you know, any of them wanting to be in the front line, all around the coast, the southeast and the southwest, wherever these planes were coming in and trying to bomb airfields and start their invasion. And I figured it would be interesting to what was that period like. Anyway, I wrote the story and it struck me that I have here a skeleton of something in which Molly now is retelling the story, reworking it. And I think it's going to be far, far better. And I think adults will enjoy this, especially if they've read things like Biggleswick and they're open to fiction of a slightly old-fashioned kind of fiction instead of perhaps the racy, pacey sort of fiction that you get these days, which is sometimes all full of plot and very little character. Now, that's not the case. That's a sweeping statement, of course, because there are very, very many different types of authors with very many different takes. And I'm not saying that that is a true statement of all fiction. But I wanted to write something that would be relevant to a modern audience and yet still be basically set in the past, mainly because I find the 1940s and just before a fascinating time in which people had manners, people had respect, people treated one another differently. The pace of life was slower. Technology was limited. And the communities were still together on the whole. And really and truly, I see that what we have had since the sort of Second World War has been the destruction of things like the family, the destruction of mental health, of health in general. And now people will argue, but we've got the NHS as a result of that. But people were much more in tune with themselves and each other, and they knew certain remedies that would work. And I think we've lost a bit of that. The farming industry, if you can call it an industry back then, was more a way of life. It was, quite subsistence. It was quite poor for a lot of people. They relied very much still on a little bit of manpower and early technology, like the tractors, when they came in the sort of late 30s and 40s during the war, which escalated the farming need to produce food, hence Dig for Victory. But so there's so many areas in which I think that we have lost a lot. That's not to say that you can go backwards, or that you might even desire to go backwards, to step into the past, although many people do, of course. And I think that it's very easy to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, well, we mustn't have any of it. And yet there was so much that was good, beneficial and necessary for a cohesive life. And I think we've lost it now. We are casting around in a very strange world, I think. And, you only have to really look at the politics of those in power to see that they're not geared to trying to help people, but actually hinder people more than ever and extract as much money from them as possible. Just take simple things like parking, in which over the last 100 years, of course, there were very few cars around in the 30s. And I appreciate that there's got to be some management of where people put their cars. But there seems to have been a line crossed now with the cameras on the motorways and cameras in the town, and the fact that if you park on a parking meter and you go over by 5 minutes, you get £100 fine, instead of saying, well, I just pay for the next hour. I mean, I can't see if you park in a bay and let's just say, for example, it's £1 an hour and you're late coming back because the appointment that you had was delayed and whatever, and you come back to your vehicle to find a ticket on it. Why you can't say to the ticket chap, said, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm a bit late, I'll just pay for the second hour, there's another £1. But no, you've infringed some policy that if you're not back in time, you're going to be charged £100, or if you pay within, say, 10 days or whatever it is, it's only 50. It just seems an extremely unfair tax and revenue generating scheme. Whereas to have paid just simply, well, I just pay for the second hour, I'll pay for that, put another coin in the meter. But that's, so that's just a very simple example of how we've lost our way as communities, as towns and villages that are there to help each other. It brings an animosity towards those that are supposedly trying to administer a town or village, and instead it turns them into dictators rather than servants who are there to help not just one individual but everybody and mitigate certain situations. So I thought with the book it would be interesting to have this character starting in today at 90 something, just shy of 100. She survived through the Second World War, through the last 90 odd years, or 80 years. And she's now, you know, approaching 100. She's probably only got a few years to live, and she's writing her memoir. And her memoir contains really the freedom and the adventures during the 1940s. But as she tells that story, she's also commenting on what life is like today and the slow progression towards a much harsher, less enjoyable life. And I can imagine that somebody who has lived through the Second World War and was brought up in the 30s and is still alive today, who might be writing, would be looking back, perhaps a little through rose-tinted glasses, that's for sure, but at the simplicity of life and then comparing it to the complexity that we are in and the uncaring social environment that we find ourselves in, the splitting up of the family, the loneliness of being on your own, the lack of real care, the sort of professional care that one gets these days as somebody comes in for 10 minutes and says all the nice things but goes off, and then it's a completely different person who comes in the next day to help you wash or change, you know, your or do your shopping or whatever it is that certain people have got. This lack of coherence, this lack of continuity that people these days are suffering. And I thought that would be a fascinating way to demonstrate to audiences what we are lacking, that we could, if we really got ourselves together, return some of the things that were good. Not suggesting that one steps back in time, but there will be so many things that I think that observances that this character could make, which will perhaps reflect to those who are a more mature audience, but a younger audience who have no notion, perhaps, of certain elements of freedom, certain, you know, the family and how people were cohesive and how people knew your business and were interested and wanted to help you. Not everybody wants to help you, of course. There'll be those, there's still jealousies and all the usual human emotions and foibles that we have. But anyway, so that's the crux of the book. And of course it's interesting because the book is called Blue Skies and Vapor Trails, and the vapor trails refer to the fighter jets in the sky, the fighter planes, they weren't jets, the propeller planes of the Spitfires and Hurricanes and Messerschmitts, and indeed some of the bombers that were going over, that were left after dogfights in the sky from the RAF. But of course, those vapor trails these days are chemtrails. And I know that there'll be those that will be dismissive that these chemtrails exist, and they'll call them contrails, etc. I appreciate that. But having read quite a bit about this period, the Battle of Britain, and the hot summer of 1940, It is fascinating to compare the weather then with the weather today, and the narrative of the global warming stuff, and how somebody in their 90s, you know, nearly 100 years old, will have seen the world and have memory of a time where it wasn't quite so bleak, and that I think somebody of that time would, you know, if they've got their faculties, as this character does have her faculties, and is able to write, hopefully coherently, as a memoir that somebody would pick up and read, and would and go, well, she remembers that there wasn't these chemtrails. And it isn't just the fact that aeroplanes happen to produce, you know, there's more of them, and they're happening to be the contrails and their jets and things. So I thought that might be a valuable book, again, dressed as fiction, but with a few things in it and a few home truths. We also, within that story, we would get what happens to Molly in between her telling of her adventure as a 12-year-old working on a farm and the things that go on in that summer, with a in tandem, I suppose, what happens in her life, how she is, you know, she marries and what happens, and how she ends up where she ends up, where she's writing on the kitchen table in a bungalow on her own with very few people around. And I think that that's something that may be of some interest, I don't know, to other people, to think, actually, I wonder how truthful all that is. And of course it's fiction, but there would be certain elements of truth, I think, from a lot of people who have lived a long life, who have memories and are being dismissed by the younger generation as if, well, none of that's important. And of course they're all on their phones, on their digital world, and distracted left, right and centre, and not really living in the real world anymore. The real world has become, if you like, boring or too taxing. And the taxing side of it, not literally taxes, but the taxing side, the difficulty of the world has been, I think, manipulated. And that would be the character slant on successive governments who've brought in policies. Now, I don't want to get into the politics particularly, but it would, because the character's really not interested. She's a farm girl that's grown up. But she would be noticing the, as I say, the breakup of the family and things coming in as a benefit. And she'd be just questioning, well, is it a benefit, some of these things? And I dare say there may be a mention or two of lockdown and what that did to her generation, and the government's strange ideas about viruses and care homes and her friends that she couldn't see and the funerals of people that she couldn't see. So in a way it's a memoir and a bit of a saga of her life wound around the central story that she's trying to tell of her youth, one particular summer that was an iconic period in British history. And so that's really, yeah, that's the book. It'll take some time to write, but I've already got about 40,000 words done. I think it'll probably be about 100,000 words when I've finished. And this is where reading other novels set in a similar sort of time period is very useful for reminding me of events and things and how people spoke and the type of lives they lived that I can borrow and mould into a unique story that I hope people will find enjoyable. There will be, of course, those who say it's a load of old rubbish, and of course they're welcome to think that. But to me, it's a lovely challenge to do so. But I haven't done as much as I would like to have done on that. There's been, during this period where I've been somewhat incapacitated, there's been a lot of thinking about it. Thinking, and of course, approaching a novel that you know, a serious novel that you wish to perhaps, what would you say, open people's minds or suggest ideas to, does take a bit of thinking. And of course, I'm still trying to learn and hone my skills as an author in telling the story in an interesting and delightful way that people will enjoy reading. A lot of people have said that they enjoyed Biggleswick, which was lovely. This won't be quite so hammering the what would you call it, that what people say is the conspiracies and things. I'm not hammering those forward. They would be just gently introduced in a way that you could either accept them or dismiss them and say, well, that's just that character who's, you know, thinking slightly weird. She's not sitting at a computer going down rabbit holes and saying, oh yes, I've heard about the satanic practices and the Freemasons and all of this. She's talking really about what she observes in the world and how it seems to be to her a sad reality that humanity has taken the wrong direction from what is important for them, the family particularly, unity, community, getting along with one another, helping, and that the money has been, I suppose, the doer of bad things, the greed and young people's confusion about wishing to be famous for doing nothing and earning lots of money on TikTok and things like that, and the fashions and, you know, that sort of thing. That's not to say that the character herself during her lifetime would not have fallen into the same traps and would like to have had a lovely dress to go to a ball and had to work hard to get it and things like that. But because her youth would have been very simple in a farmhouse in Sussex in which they don't have electricity, they don't have a telephone, you know, at that sort of time, these things were just coming on stream and people were living a much, well, simpler life, but harder, but were used to it. They didn't know any different. You know, that's how she grew up. And these days, as I know for a fact, when my son, my eldest, moved into his first house, he wasn't happy unless there were everything, including all the white goods, carpets, curtains and everything in place. And then I compare that to when I moved into this house some 34 years ago, or maybe 35 years ago now, time ticks by very quickly, and there was barely, it was just nothing. There were no curtains. There was a perished carpet with the rubber backing on it that had to be stripped out. There's no central heating. There were some very naff gas fires. There was gas. And everything had to be done from scratch. It was all I could afford at the time. I love this house. This house has a very positive vibration. And I've done some crazy things in this house, from running studios and doing interviews, as people will know, but also in earlier times I built the interior set of a beach hut in my front room, gutted the front room, built this beach hut interior set with lights and fake foliage and things, and did some experiments and tried to, you know, in my attempt to try and find something that would satisfy my need as a creative person, and also earn sufficient funds to keep going. And I mean, I've done all sorts of weird things in this house. It's been quite amazing, really. And I've written plays and books, none of them really published. But I have had all these different projects. I can't remember how I got onto that and why I was talking about that. But anyway, so that's where I am, and that's where my focus has been. As I have been smoking my pipe, reading and thinking, a lot of thinking. I haven't really, you know, of course, this crippling disease, or not disease, whatever it is, this strange muscle issue has enforced me to stay more at home and not go on the land, which is what I'm desperate to do. So once this is over, once I'm back to normal health, and I have no thoughts that wouldn't happen, I'm very much expecting to be back into normal health and get on with the other land. It's enforced me to think. Fortunately, it's not affected my brain or my soul or my, you know, my ability to think. But it has been hard. It's been very hard. But sometimes you need that hard life. I think especially as a creative person, you need to go through certain harsh conditions so that you can write about it. So this, what I'm going through now, may well be a condition that helps me understand what perhaps being 90 is about. That you can't move very quickly, that bending down is a slow process, that your body is frailer. And, you know, so in a way, it's almost as if the universe has put me through this so I can experience something that I would never have experienced until I get older myself. And maybe that's why this is. Who knows? And who knows how these things work? But we will see. Anyway, I think I'll leave it there, really. But I must go and pull this plug out of my nose and see if my bleeding has stopped. That was a little unexpected. But anyway, I hope that you're all well, and I will catch up with you soon. Apologies for not doing very many Naked Englishmans. Some of the days are just pretty much the same, and there's very little to talk about. So there you are. Anyway, I shall crack on with the day. Until next time, thanks for listening, and goodbye.